Hello and welcome. Oliver Kim is my name. We're on page 24 of the book, top box, drawing amino acids. You see a structural formula of an amino acid. And let's have a look at the central carbon atom. There are four groups connected to the central carbon atom. On one side, we have a hydrogen, which is pointing downwards in this picture. On the other side, we have an R group, a rest or a radical group. Now, this is how the amino acids are different because they have different R's. The simplest R would be simply another H. We have an NH2 group towards the left, it's the amine group, and we have a carboxylic acid group, or carboxyl group, a COOH group, to the right. And amino acids are called like this because they have an amine group, an NH2, and a COOH group. Next box, amino acid diversity. Amino acids differ because they have different R groups. As I already said, there are 20 naturally occurring amino acids that can be found in living things. A few other living things have other amino acids as well. But that these are kind of special cases and have evolved after the ribosome has learned how to synthesize polypeptides. So we now moved on further. One box, peptide bonds and polypeptides. You already know this from the previous page. Here we now have a specific look at the peptide bond. You see that the peptide bond is formed between the carbon and the nitrogen of the adjacent amino acid. Now, the nitrogen is from the amine group, and the carbon, that's the carbon, it has the double bonded oxygen attached to it. And this is a peptide bond, and chains of amino acids are called polypeptides. And let's say that you make a polypeptide of 5 amino acids, then you of course have 4 peptide bonds, because it's always one less. Next box, page 24, top, polypeptides and proteins. Now, what is the difference between a polypeptide and a protein? A polypeptide is an unbranched chain of amino acids, which is synthesized, made because a gene on the DNA codes for it. Okay, so the information on the gene is then later on translated into a polypeptide. Now, what is a protein? Well, protein and polypeptides are chemically, of course, almost the same thing. However, a protein can be made by one or more polypeptide chains. So polypeptide rather is a more chemical description, while a protein often is a slightly, can be more complex, and also is more used when we talk about the function of something. For example, when we say an enzyme is a protein, okay? Often it's made of multiple individual polypeptides. Next box, proteins and proteomes. What is a proteome? A proteome are all of the proteins found in, is produced by a cell. And different cells of the human body have different proteomes. So a skin cell, for example, makes different proteins than the cell of a gland, than the cell, I don't know, an intestinal cell, a nerve cell, and so on. Of course, this is the case because these cells are all specialized, and even though we have the same, all the cells have the same DNA, the DNA is used to make different proteins. In cell differentiation in chapter 1, I already talked about that. And what you see in the picture on page 24, that is seems to be a two-dimensional, or a single-dimensional, I don't know, gel, electrophoresis gel, and each of the black dots over there can be considered to be represents an individual protein, okay? So, page 25, protein structure and function. We talk about the box on the left, protein conformation. The conformation, when we say the shape of a protein, its three-dimensional shape, that is referred to as its conformation. Proteins are not simply strings that are floating around in a cell, but actually are rolled up into a complex three-dimensional structure, and then we say the conformation of the protein. And what you can now do is the following. You can look at this drawing over there, and you see that there are many spirals. Okay, you can see the individual polypeptide chains, and there are many spirals. These spirals are all known as alpha helices. High-level people have to know that. And there are also light gray parts, not the stringy ones, but towards the top, there are very light gray parts. Difficult to see. These are so-called beta sheets. They're supposed to represent arrows. And these are two so-called secondary structure motifs in a protein. And you can see that the protein is rolled up in a complex three-dimensional manner. What holds it in place? Well, hydrogen bonds, for example, they basically hold and stabilize the secondary structures, the alpha helices and the beta sheets. So the three-dimensional, the conformation of a protein is stabilized, among other things, by hydrogen bonds. Next box, top right, denaturation. Proteins can denature, and when they denature, they become inactivated and they change their shape. And there are two things that can do that, heat and extremes of pH. So, of course, heating up a protein, like for example egg, changes its, or if you boil meat, then you see that it changes its consistency, but there is no way that once it has denatured that you are able to reverse it. What is an extreme pH? Well, this depends on the protein. Enzymes, digestive enzymes in your stomach, of course, are used to a low pH, and a neutral pH for them might be considered extreme. So you cannot always say that a neutral pH is the best for protein. Often it is, but there are many cases where this is not the case, because it really depends where the protein can be found. So if you're shifting the protein to an extreme pH, it also refolds, it loses its structure irreversibly, and stops to function. Page 25, bottom right. Functions of proteins. There's a whole list here. Even though all proteins are made of the same 20 amino acids, arranged differently, of course, proteins have a very wide range of different functions. Of course, enzymes, I'm going to talk about them, very important. Hormones, some hormones, not all of them, some hormones are proteins. Antibodies are those that bind against antigens. The antibodies are produced by our immune system. You also have certain pigments in your eyes called retinol, okay, which is able to absorb light. That is a protein. There are certain whole bunch of structural proteins like collagen, okay, and this basically prevents tissues like, for example, the skin from tearing. It holds the cells together, in other words, okay. Or also even spider silk, that's also a structural protein, okay. So what my advice here is the following. Please know the different categories of the proteins and also a named example. We are now flipping over to page 26, and now I'm explaining to you now how enzymes work. Page 26, on the right side, substrates and active sites, the box is called. What you see over here is a drawing of an enzyme and a substrate. The enzyme is a protein, of course, and it is a biological catalyst. So what do enzymes do? They speed up chemical reactions. That's number one thing that you have to know. And the second thing you have to know is that an enzyme binds to a substrate. That's the substance that the enzyme acts on, like a lock and a key. So the substrate and the enzyme, they fit together like a lock and a key. So this means for every specific chemical reaction, you need to have a specific enzyme. Otherwise, it's not going to fit into the substrate. Now, where is the active site? The active site is the place on the enzyme that binds against the substrate. And you can see in the second picture on the right side, it forms an enzyme-substrate complex, and the black colored substrate fits perfectly into the enzyme. And then what does the enzyme do in the next picture? The substrate is split up into two parts, and then we have the end products, okay? And this reaction here, and the enzyme can be reused, of course, and it will be reused, but what we have now is we have the enzyme makes it more easy to make the reaction, because it lowers the activation energy, and it also increases the chance of when it joins two substances together. It can also go into the other way, where two substrates make one end product. It increases the chance of them reacting with each other. Okay, so page 26, immobilized enzymes. Now we're talking a little bit about biotechnology. What does this mean? How can we use enzymes for biotechnology, for food production, for whatever, for engineering, for medicine, and so on? And the so-called immobilized enzyme, and these enzymes are fixed, so they do not float around freely, they're fixed. And what happens is that we make these enzymes, we fix them to a so-called a solid structure, so that they cannot be washed away, and then we can pour some substrate over it, and then the enzymes will react on the substrate, and we can make an end product. Okay. One example of this would be the production of lactose-free milk. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to explain lactose-free milk, and then I'm going to go back to the immobilized enzymes to explain this a little bit more. I'm going to explain the drawing here in the production of lactose-free milk. Lactose is milk sugar, which can be found in milk, and this is not, some people are lactose intolerant, and when they drink milk, then they get all sorts of funny conditions like diarrhea. So, and lactose-free milk can be produced by breaking down the lactose into glucose and galactose with an enzyme called lactase. Of course, we cannot directly mix in the enzyme lactase into the milk. However, there are some certain disadvantages. First of all, it's expensive. We're losing the lactase. We're also adding an enzyme to the milk, so we're contaminating the milk in that sense. And there are also a whole range of other disadvantages. I'll explain you how this works first. First of all, we mix so-called alginate beads with sodium alginate. And these beads can now contain the enzyme lactase. And then we have them in a container on the drawing on the right. So we have the alginate beads, which contain the lactase, and then we pour milk containing lactose over it. And the milk kind of seeps through these beads, they get in contact with the lactase, and the lactase is my mistake, with the lactose, the milk containing the lactose gets in contact with the enzyme lactase. The lactase breaks down the lactose into glucose and galactose. And at the bottom, we now have lactose-free milk, which tastes sweeter because it contains now glucose. Now, I go back to the original box, to the box immobilized enzymes. What is the advantage of doing it like this and not simply mixing in lactase into the milk? Well, first of all, you have a better control over the whole system. Okay, you can add or remove enzymes because you simply add or remove some of these alginate beads that contain the lactase enzyme. You can have higher enzyme concentrations. It's possible to reuse the enzymes because you are not losing them with the milk. And we can also stabilize them so they can be more stable against changes of pH and temperature. And the products are also not contaminated with the enzymes, because when I buy lactose-free milk, I only want to buy lactose-free milk and not also the enzyme lactase with it. Okay, so that is, there are many methods of enzyme immobilization. You can attach them to glass, you can attach them to a gel, and you can bond enzymes together. So that's all in the box immobilized enzymes. I move on to page 27 right now. There are three environmental factors that affect enzyme activity. It's the concentration of the substrate, effect of substrate, concentration on the top right, it's the effect of temperature on the left side, and also the effect of pH. Of course, pH and temperature we already talked about, because I already told you that extreme pH and temperature can denature the enzymes. So, first of all, at the very top box, factors affecting enzyme activity, it simply summarizes this. And there is always, on the y-axis we have the enzyme activity, and on the x-axis we have either temperature, substrate concentration, or pH. So first box on the right, effect of substrate concentration. You can see that at very low substrate concentrations, the enzyme activity is of course very low. And the reason is because the active sites, there is no substrate there for the enzyme to react with. And therefore, of course, it will not form any products. If there's nothing there to work with, then it's basically not working. When we increase the substrate concentration, the curve rises, but at the very high substrate concentration, the enzyme activity does not go further up because the curve, as you can see, levels off. The reason is because all of the active sites are occupied, so the enzyme is already working at maximum speed. So, next one, effect of temperature. You can see at very low temperature, the enzyme activity is low, and this is because chemical reactions generally are low at low temperature. We are now increasing the temperature to an optimum temperature, and this is where we see the peak, and then there's a rapid decline at higher temperatures. And the reason being is because if the temperature is too high, if it is above the optimum temperature, then the enzyme denatures and the enzyme activity drops very quickly. However, when we lower the temperature again, it's still going to stay low because the enzymes have been denatured and they're broken and they don't work anymore. Effect of pH, that's the next box here at the bottom. You see that we also have a peak, a very sharp peak, and you will see that on either side of the optimum pH, the enzyme activity is low because it denatures on both sides. Different enzymes have a different optimum pH, depending where you can find them in the body. It says you're now designing enzyme experiments in the box on the right. Generally, this is a box which simply explains how to set up experiments. The independent variable, that is the variable that you change, okay? So for example, if you change the temperature, then this is your independent variable. The dependent variable is the outcome, basically, or the thing that you measure as an outcome. And it should be quantitative. That means it should be measurable, and it should be a numerical value. In the case of enzymes, the enzyme activity can be measured either by the product formed or the substrate used up in the process. And control of variables, that is all the variables, all the factors that have to be maintained the same. So for example, if you would like to measure the enzyme activity by changing the substrate concentration, then temperature and pH should be your controlled variables and have to be the same, because you only want to change substrate concentration, which is your independent variable. So this was page 27. We now go over to page 28 and we start now the big section of DNA. Page 28. Structure of DNA and RNA, drawing nucleotides, top box. A nucleotide is a building block of nucleic acids. In the nucleic acids, you have DNA and RNA. And one nucleotide has a phosphate group, a sugar. DNA has deoxyribose sugar. RNA has ribose sugar. First important difference. And there is a base attached. And there are four bases. DNA has four bases and RNA has four bases. A, G, and C are the same for both, but DNA has T and RNA has U, which is uracil. You have to know the names of the bases. A is adenine, C is cytosine, G is guanine, and T is thymine, and U is uracil. Okay, so that is very important over here. So what you will not find is you will not find a nucleotide with a ribose sugar for DNA and a thymine base T, because the T is only found in DNA and the ribose sugar is only found in RNA. So that's a contradiction. Okay, structure of DNA and RNA. So first of all, what does it mean? It says here in DNA the two strands are antiparallel. So what you see is that there are two strands on the DNA and they run into opposite directions. They point into opposite directions, and this is referred to as being antiparallel. The DNA structure, you might want to reference now to the box on the side over here. Between A and T, there are two hydrogen bonds. Between G and C, there are three hydrogen bonds. This is called complementary base pairing. Now, in RNA, we already now know two differences between RNA. RNA has U and no T, and RNA has ribose sugar, but there's a third difference. DNA is a double helix, it's double-stranded, and RNA is usually single-stranded. Yes, for those of you who are experts here, it is possible to have also double-stranded RNA, but generally this is not a requirement. So, next box down here, model making and the discovery of structure of DNA. Watson and Crick, what they have done is the following. They've got had measurement data and they were able to make paper models and to deduce the structure of DNA. Okay, so they basically they didn't know how DNA looks like. They had the chemical measurement data, they made paper models and they tried to fit it together like a puzzle piece, and they figured out, well, actually the only way that it works is that we have a double helix. Okay, there are other folks at that time I read that proposed even a triple helix. Okay, but this was didn't work. Okay, so page 29, DNA replication. DNA has to be copied before the cells divide. Okay, and DNA replication is semi-conservative. This means that every new DNA contains one strand old DNA and one strand new DNA. This is called semi-conservative. So we're conserving half of the original strand. And DNA replication is possible because of the complementary base pairing rules, T always going with A and G always going with C. Now, there are theoretically two other forms of replications that were proposed but which are not correct. One is called conservative replication, and this is when we keep the original strand. So when we have an original strand, we copy it, then we have one strand which is still the original and one which is completely new. So we're conserving the old strand. This is not happening. Why do we mention it? It's because the people at that time, they didn't know which one is correct. And there is also another one, theoretical one, called dispersive replication, in which basically it's not, we have the new DNA contains part of the old and the new DNA, but not the complete strand, okay? So it's kind of it's a mix of both. One section is from the old one section is from the new one. These are the three theoretical possibilities. Okay, and then they did an experiment, the so-called the Meselson-Stahl experiment, which proved that semi-conservative replication is correct. Okay, I need to explain this over here. I think in the book it's a little bit short. It's on page 29 on the right side. So what we now need to do is the following, and I'm going to explain you the drawing here at the bottom. You have to understand that we have to now label. We somehow have to label the DNA to indicate if it is an original strand or not. Okay, and what we're doing is our original strand contains nitrogen 15. This is heavy nitrogen. It's a nitrogen isotope, which is a little bit heavier. And we're starting over here on the left side with the original DNA. How do we make that? We grow our bacteria in food containing nitrogen 15. And then we allow the bacteria to copy. Okay, and what they've done is the following. They've given the bacteria new food, nitrogen 14, and then they checked how does the new DNA look like. And what they found here, it says here generations 0, 1, 2, and 3. So in generation 0, we can see that we only have nitrogen 15 present. But in generation 1, after the cells divided the first time, we saw that every DNA had an intermediate mass. Or density, that would be better, okay? Because each strand consisted of nitrogen 14 and nitrogen 15 containing DNA, okay? Because we grew them only with nitrogen 15, so it was kind of heavy. Then we changed the food, we gave them nitrogen 14 food. The bacteria used the nitrogen 14 food, and it started to make new DNA using that. And the new DNA, we had then two cells, and they had an intermediate mass or density. Okay, and then with every generation that we added, more and more nitrogen 14 DNA was made. Okay, so that means that it was short. We still had the nitrogen, the intermediate DNA present at the same concentration. So with time, the band shifted over, and more nitrogen-14 DNA was made, because of course more and more nitrogen-14 was incorporated. Okay, so this Meselson-Stahl experiment was a proof that DNA replication is semi-conservative. Stages in DNA replication. So this is the standard level way. The first stage is the following. We need an enzyme called helicase. So that's a box on the bottom of page 29. The stage one is this helicase. That's an enzyme. It sits on the DNA and it breaks the hydrogen bonds, or you can also say it unwinds the double helix of the DNA, exposing the bases. And in stage two, we have DNA polymerase. DNA polymerase reads the original strand of the DNA and inserts the complementary nucleotide. So if the polymerase reads an A, then it will insert a T. Okay, and because it does this with both strands, with both sides of the DNA, we then have two DNA strands, each containing original and new DNA. Okay, and stage three is the newly formed DNA molecules. They are then they rewind again, they form a double helix, and then we have two molecules of DNA. Okay, and then of course then the cell can divide, and one molecule goes into one side and one goes into the other side. Okay, so this was the stages of DNA copying, DNA replication, in a nutshell, as I used to say. So we flip the page. We are now on page 30, and I'm going to now talk about transcription and translation. Okay, so the point, so DNA can be copied because of cell division, but the real point of DNA is it because it codes for proteins. And the thing is, so it contains a genetic code that tells the ribosome ultimately on how, what amino acids to use. And the protein making of protein requires two stages. The first stage is called transcription, and this is when a gene is copied to make messenger RNA, mRNA. Okay, so what we have is we have RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase opens the DNA, and one strand of the DNA is used to make mRNA using complementary base pairing. For every G, it will insert a C. For every A, it will insert a U, because we're making mRNA. Okay, and for every G, a C, C, and you get the idea. Okay, and when the gene has been transcribed, we have a piece of mRNA. Okay, so the RNA polymerase can make another copy of this gene, and so we have one piece of DNA, but we can make many mRNA copies. Okay, and this process is called transcription. So the information is passed on from the DNA to the mRNA. So the next thing is the following. Now, which side is used? Okay, for making the mRNA, the top one or the bottom one? Okay, and there are some names over here, and it's called sense and antisense strand of the DNA. So the mRNA strand, and maybe you would like to follow along on the box on the right, it's called DNA and RNA sequences. And it says here, example, mRNA strand, AUC, GCU. This mRNA strand can be used now that it makes sense, okay? And it makes sense because it is used to make a protein, a polypeptide. Okay, so this means that the DNA from which it was copied must be complementary. Okay, so first of all, the mRNA strand has AUC, no T of course, GCU, and now the original DNA strand which was used to make this must be TAGCGA. Okay, and because the mRNA strand makes sense, the DNA strand from which it was copied is known as the antisense strand. Okay. So that means the antisense strand of the DNA is used to make the mRNA strand. Okay, so that is simply from the definitions. The mRNA strand makes sense. So that means the original DNA from which it was copied was the antisense, because it's complementary. Okay, so we now have our mRNA. Now we can actually make proteins, and that is called translation on the bottom box of page 30. So translation occurs at the ribosome. There are two places in a eukaryotic cell where you can find ribosomes freely floating inside the cytoplasm and also on the rough endoplasmic reticulum. In prokaryotes, in bacteria, you have, of course, the ribosomes floating only in the cytoplasm, and therefore in bacteria, transcription and translation take both place in the cytoplasm, while in eukaryotes, the transcription takes place in the nucleus and translation, the making of the polypeptide, in the cytoplasm where you can find the ribosomes. Okay, so let's quickly explain this. I'm going to go through the number 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So, translation, number 1, first of all, the mRNA, the messenger RNA, binds to the ribosome. And what happens then is the following, that tRNA, these are transfer RNA molecules, number 2, they have an amino acid attached to them. And they have an anticodon, and this anticodon is complementary to the codons which you can find on the mRNA. Okay, so this means that so the anticodons, they kind of match to the codons, and this only if it matches, it will go into the ribosome and it will read off 3 bases at a time. So, okay, and down here at number 3, it says there are 3 binding sites for the tRNA molecules, and the tRNA will go into the ribosome to these binding sites, and when you have 2 tRNA molecules next to each other, then you can see that the 2 amino acids are located next to each other, and that's number 4, and now there can be, you can make a peptide bond between the 2 amino acids, and then the old tRNA molecule is removed and a new one can go in, and the ribosome therefore moves along always 3 bases at a time, and these 3 bases are referred to as codons on the mRNA. Okay, so the reason why this is the case is because you have 20 amino acids, and if you have 3 bases for one codon, then we have 64 different possibilities. We have AAA, AAU, AAC, and so on. All of the combinations make 64 combinations. That's plenty, more than enough than we need to code for the 20 amino acids, okay? So, and at the, when the end of the mRNA has been reached, or for high-level people, when the stop codon has been reached, then this is a sign for the ribosome to be finished making the polypeptide, okay? So the tRNA molecules, they carry the correct amino acid to the ribosome, and they are, and because they're different for, they're different tRNAs for the different amino acids, only those that fit where the codons, anticodons, where they match, only those will actually be incorporated. And if there's a mistake on the mRNA, then it can be the wrong amino acid will be built in, and then you have a possibly a protein that does not work. So page 31, the genetic code. The genetic code is universal. What does this mean? This means all living things use the same genetic code, and the genetic code refers to the triplet of bases code for the same amino acid in all living things. And I'm just going to tell you how you can read this table over here. It's quite simple, but it is it needs to be explained. So you have a table over here, and let's say I give you the codon on the mRNA. We always, these tables are always referred to the codons and not to the anticodons on the tRNA. Always the mRNA codons. And AUG, let's give it an example in AUG. So what you do is the following. You look at the very left side, you look for A. It says here it's labeled, the table is labeled UCAG, so you go into A. And in this A box, there are, a whole bunch of amino acids written in A, in the row where you have A. And then the second base is U, A, because you want to find AUG. So, and U is the first column. So A, then you go the second base of the codon on the mRNA at the top. So you go to the U column. And the AU, they're now the following: isoleucine, 1, 2, 3 times. And then the last one is methionine or slash start. So now which one of these is it now? So we have to, as told you, AUG. So we look at the very right side. We go to the G on the very right side. And you can see that AUG is methionine, or the son, also known as the start codon. Okay, so if given a DNA sequence, if you're given an antisense DNA sequence, then you you can, if you're given the antisense sequence, then you can transcribe the mRNA, and then you can use the mRNA to read off the amino acid sequence using this here. Okay, so 31. What you have over here is the production of human insulin in the bacteria, and this should illustrate the importance of the universality of the genetic code. So this means if we have human insulin DNA and if put it into bacteria, like E. coli bacteria, then E. coli will produce human insulin. Okay, so basically different species are able to understand the different genetic code. Okay, and insulin was one of the first ones where this was actually done. So you see down here is simply the different amino acids of insulin. You can count how many amino acids there are, and in this insulin, and then you multiply it by 3, and then you know how many bases the mRNA was long. Page 31, bottom, polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. That's a method for doing in vitro DNA replication. What does this mean? You can copy the DNA without cells. You just have the original DNA, you add the right enzymes, so-called tag polymerase, which does the copying. And then you can copy to a very large quantity, you can copy the DNA, and PCR is extremely important for molecular biology and also for forensics. And the enzyme that does the copying is called tag DNA polymerase. Tag stands comes from Ceramus aquaticus, which is a temperature resistant bacteria. Okay, so the enzymes, they don't break when you heat it up, they don't denature. The polymerase doesn't denature. Next page, page 32, cell respiration. So, cell respiration should not be confused with the respiratory system. Cell respiration is the controlled release of energy from organic compounds in order to produce ATP. Where does cell respiration occur? Cell respiration occurs in the cytoplasm of the cells and also in the mitochondria. Mitochondria being the powerhouse of the cell, you probably have already heard. There are two types of cell respiration, aerobic cell respiration and anaerobic cell respiration. And the first important difference is that aerobic respiration requires oxygen, that is might be seen as a disadvantage, but has the advantage that it produces a large amount it releases large amounts of energy. Anaerobic respiration does not require oxygen, but the amount of ATP released, the amount of energy released is only small. So only in aerobic respiration is glucose completely oxidized and converted to CO2 and water. So let's have a look at the two diagrams down here in the I didn't tell you the name of the boxes now. So the first box was energy and cells, where I have given you a definition of cell respiration. And now I'm in the box aerobic and anaerobic cell respiration, which compares these two. Okay. So for example, in anaerobic cell respiration, you see this big arrow going to the right. Glucose is converted to a substance called pyruvate. So you split glucose into two molecules of pyruvate, and this produces a small amount of ATP. And in aerobic respiration, the pyruvate is converted to carbon dioxide water, and you get a large amount of ATP, as I already mentioned. So the next box is energy for muscles. Now you're gonna ask, when do we actually become anaerobic? Well, your muscles become anaerobic if you, for example, run too fast. Then your legs start to hurt, your muscles start to ache, and the reason being is because it builds up lactic acid, because the pyruvate is converted later on to lactate or lactic acid by animals, and because the muscles don't have enough oxygen, okay? So that is anaerobic respiration. You go from glucose to pyruvate, and then the pyruvate is converted to lactic acid or lactate, which builds up in your muscles. So your muscles become anaerobic when you run too fast. Page 32, the bottom part is, you can use yeast for brewing and baking, and the thing is the following, that when you bake yeast, then you make a dough, and the yeast now starts to form carbon dioxide, because in anaerobic respiration in yeast, you produce carbon dioxide and ethanol, and that causes the dough to rise. And when you're brewing beer or wine or whatever, then the ethanol is also doing anaerobic respiration, and it will start to make also ethanol, which is ethyl alcohol, which is the alcohol that you find in alcoholic beverages. So that is basically an example how anaerobic respiration can be used and is used by yeast for biotechnology. Page 33, respirometers is the title, respirometers and respiration rates. So the thing is the following, I'm going to explain you now this experiment over here. How can we now measure respiration rate? You see over here there's a so-called potassium hydroxide solution on the right, on the bottom, and this potassium hydroxide solution absorbs carbon dioxide, okay? And what we now can do is, if we have now in this test tube, if you have animals like insects or so, and what they will do is they will use up oxygen and they will produce CO2. And therefore, the overall volume of gas should not change, so we gotta make it change. Okay, so they use up oxygen, they produce CO2, and we don't really know if they're doing cell respiration or not, because you don't see the volume of gas changing, because for every oxygen that's taken in, we make CO2, right? So what we're doing is now with the potassium hydroxide, this one removes the CO2. So there is in overall a decrease in gas volume in the test tube, okay? And this causes the water being sucked in, and you can actually read from the water level how much gas was actually removed from the test tube, okay? So that is the experiment using a respirometer, okay? So we're there to measure how much cell respiration takes place. Ethical implications, a whole bunch of ethics, it's not really difficult. Will the animals suffer pain? Are there any unacceptable risks to the animals, and so on? Because we're doing animal experiments over here, but essentially I think there should not be a problem here because we're not killing the animals, we're just measuring how much oxygen they're using. But of course it's like this, that if they don't have any oxygen they're going to die. So, and then we have over here, also at the very bottom, we have the analysis of data from respirometer experiments. How do you calculate the average? That's of course one thing, that calculating mean results, which you should already do. You have also plotting graph with range bars. So what you have to do is you plot the average, but then you can also plot either the standard deviation plus minus or the largest and the lowest value. And the reason why you do that is because you want to determine whether you, how significant your mean value is. Point three, you describe a trend. I do not like the idea that they actually connected the dots over here in this diagram on page 33 at the bottom, because you should draw a line of best fit. So I would have taken points off here, but okay. Yeah, and then at the end you have to evaluate the data. Okay, evaluation of the data means that you have to, what does the data mean? Is the data significant? Is it relevant? And so on. My advice is the following. If you do not want to do animal experiments, then you can also use seeds, because seed germinating seeds, they need oxygen as well. I'm on page 34 right now. Top box, introducing photosynthesis. Define photosynthesis, it is the production of carbon, of organic substances using light energy and carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is not an organic substance, but we can convert this into glucose with the help of light energy and water. You see the overall equation there, carbon dioxide plus water plus light energy makes glucose and oxygen. Notice that it looks like to be looks like the reversal of aerobic respiration. Yeah, it is, but it, the process is not the reversal, okay? But it looks like, the equation looks very similar. Now, how does photosynthesis occur? There are two important stages, the light-dependent and the light-independent reaction. In the light-dependent reaction, which is the first stage, light energy is used to split water into oxygen and hydrogens and electrons. And these electrons are then now carry the energy of the light, and are then used in the second stage in the light-independent reaction to do so-called carbon fixation. So carbon fixation is the process in which the carbon dioxide is converted into organic substances using the energy from the electrons. In the light dependent reaction, the first stage, you not only convert light energy into electrons energy, but also into ATP. Okay, so the light dependent reaction produces ATP and high energy electrons. When photosynthesis, at the very beginning, there was no oxygen on Earth, and the oxygen that is now in the atmosphere was formed by photosynthesis. And it was like this, that the first organisms that invented photosynthesis produced oxygen as a waste product. And this oxygen was released into the atmosphere, but in the atmosphere it did not start to accumulate yet. Rather, it reacted with the iron to form rust, so-called iron oxide, and this rust or iron oxide deposited and are now so-called banded iron formations. So for the first, when oxygen was released, at first the oxygen was kind of reacted away by the substances that were already present on Earth, and the oxygen could not build up yet. Only when all of these substances have reacted away, then oxygen started to build up. And these substances that reacted away, the iron in principle formed so-called banded iron formations, which you can still see in rock samples. Next box, so this was the photosynthesis and the atmosphere, okay? Next box, absorption and action spectra. I'm going to explain both boxes now at the same time, more or less. First of all, there are so-called photosynthetic pigments in plants. The main photosynthetic pigments in plants is chlorophyll. And there are two types of chlorophyll, chlorophyll A and B, and both of these chlorophylls, they absorb very much in the red area and also in the blue area of the light spectrum, but not so much in the green area. This is the reason why the green is reflected, why plants are green. So what you see over here in the wavelength in the diagram, light nanometers around the 400, 450, that is the short wavelength, that's the blue area, you see the peaks are very high, and the 650 to 650 nanometers, that is the red area, and you see all that there is the peak is very high, but at around from 500 to 600 nanometers, you see that the peaks are very low, the chlorophyll is not absorbed very well. This is also where you find the green light. That was the absorption spectra of photosynthesis. Now, now we move on to the next box, action spectrum, and you will notice that the action spectrum is somewhat similar to the absorption spectrum. The action spectrum now indicates at which wavelengths is there most photosynthesis. Kind of obvious, well, of course, there where the chlorophyll or where the pigments absorb most. So, I mean, it's kind of clear that also over here in the red and in the blue area, we have to have high peaks, and this is what we see. However, we also see that in the green area at around 550 to 600 nanometers, it is not completely zero, and this is because there are also accessory pigments in plants that allow the absorption of a little bit of green light at least. Okay. So having said that, on page 35, I'm not going to explain, well, I can explain the experiment over here a little bit. What we do is, just to explain the setup over here, we can measure photosynthesis. You see over here, there is in the diagram a light source, which is important, a thermometer to make sure that the temperature is okay. And we have the water at the right temperature, and we have some pond weed. And this pond weed will start to form oxygen bubbles that we can count, or we can catch them to calculate the volume. The sodium hydrogen carbonate solution, that is important for supplying the plant with carbon dioxide. Okay, the three boxes at the bottom. Light, effect of light intensity, bottom left. The higher the light intensity, the higher the rate of photosynthesis, of course, but only up to maximum point. Okay, that is important because when the light intensity is too high, photosynthesis can actually also go down because you were damaging the cells. Effect of carbon dioxide concentration. This graph is very similar to the substrate activity enzyme curve that you already mentioned before. It is like this, that at very low CO2 concentrations, at very, very low CO2 concentrations, there is zero photosynthesis. You need to have a small level of CO2 present for photosynthesis to start. So this line does not start at the zero point, but is shifted further to the right. Slightly to the right, because you need a small critical amount of CO2 for photosynthesis even to start. And also the effect of temperature is very similar to the denaturation curve. At very low temperature, photosynthesis is very low, of course, because the enzymes do not work very well. And if the temperature is too high, denaturation occurs. It goes up, the photosynthesis, and then it drops down quite quickly. So it should not surprise us that these curves are very similar to the enzyme activity curves, and the reason being that, of course, photosynthesis is an enzyme-driven process, okay? So that is basically it, and now I can flip the page. No, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to give you a general comment. How can you measure the rate of photosynthesis, okay? You can measure this either by CO2 uptake or oxygen formation. And this is the reason why in the box here at on page 35 at the top, designing experiments, okay, this is measuring the oxygen production, okay? So the effect of light intensity, CO2 concentration, and temperature on the rate of photosynthesis can be measured by the production of oxygen, okay? Because the more oxygen we make, the higher the rate of photosynthesis. So, page 36, separating photosynthetic pigments by chromatography. This is a mandatory requirement. You just follow through the whole thing here. We first have to smash the leaves to extract the pigments. We're placing the pigments on filter paper, and then we're submerging it into a solvent, and those substances, those pigments that move furthest up are best soluble. And the important thing here is, and that's something that you must know, is you have to know how to calculate the RF value or the RF factor. And that's kind of like a little bit like the percentage or the ratio of the spot traveled in relation to the solvent. Okay, so let's look at number 7, at 0.7, and I will show you how 0.7 works. On 0.7, you see that the strip of filter paper with the concentrated spot of the pigment is submerged, and the pigment spot is not under in the liquid, but above it. But the liquid is soaked up into the paper, and it will carry along the pigments, but it will carry along those pigments best that are dissolvable best in the solvent. Okay, and then when you take out the filter paper, you have to mark the place where the, how far the solvent went, and then you can mark the place where the pigment spots are, and then you can calculate the ratio. And the higher the pigment is moved up with the solvent, the higher the ratio. So it's almost like a percentage, okay, of the maximum. Yeah? That is a mandatory experiment. You have to know how to calculate the RF value. Okay, and the reason why we calculate the RF values is so that you can compare different chromatographies of yeah. So a certain chlorophyll A in this case, it has an RF value of 0.65. It should always be 0.65 under these conditions. Okay. Next point, 36, page 36, bottom. Results of an investigation into limiting factors. So what is a limiting factor? A limiting factor is the factor, if you reduce it too much, it will influence or stop or photosynthesis. So in other words, it, the limiting factor is kind of like the bottleneck. Yeah, it doesn't. And in this case, we have two factors that we would like to investigate: temperature and carbon dioxide concentration. Okay, and look at the box, the key here, and look at the lines. So in the box, in the key, it says here 20 degrees centigrade at 0.035% carbon dioxide, and 30 degrees and at 20 degrees the same carbon dioxide concentration. And look at the line, and you will see that the dots, the circles and the X's are both over each other. It doesn't matter if we change the temperature, because both of them will be on the same line. And this means that something else must be limiting, which is the carbon dioxide. If you look at the solid line and the dashed line, you can see that the change in temperature will have an effect now on the overall rate of photosynthesis. And this means that here now, carbon dioxide is not limiting. We have enough carbon dioxide because it's 0.15% carbon dioxide, which is a high carbon dioxide level. Okay, and here temperature does have an effect. Okay, because we have plenty of CO2, so temperature over here becomes limiting. Okay, so you see that it depends really very much on which one of the following, because a reaction cannot take place if a certain critical substance is missing. And if CO2 is not present in sufficiently high concentrations, then also photosynthesis cannot take place, and CO2 is then limiting. Okay, so this was topic 2. Okay, I wish you a nice day.